accused of violating and were held in contempt by the trial court for so doing. Now, it is noteworthy here that Rule E, subdivision E, is as follows: the publication of any matter which may prevent a fair trial, improperly influence the court or the jury, or tend in any manner to interfere with administration of justice, and F, the publication of any matter obtained as a result of a violation of this rule. So that, as I interpret the case, if some court official or someone connected with the trial of the case should violate the rule, he might be held in contempt. And if he made a report to a member of the press and the press published a story based on such statement, under F, the member of the press might be held in contempt. The trial court did hold these defendants in contempt. The case was appealed by the defendants to the Court of Appeals of Maryland, which I take to be their Supreme Court. That court reversed the conviction of the defendants. It's a rather long opinion. I'll not read it all. I'll simply read this syllabus. Rule of the Supreme Bench of Baltimore City, making the publication of any matter which may prevent a fair trial, improperly influence court or jury, or tend in any manner to interfere with administration of justice, punishable by contempt, is invalid as too broad under the doctrine that words used must be of such a nature as to create a clear and present danger that they will bring about the substantive evils sought to be avoided. Application for certiorari was made to the Supreme Court of the United States and was denied without reason being given for the denial. Now, in these cases which I have mentioned, Bridges versus California, Craig versus Harney, and those, it appears that the Supreme Court of the United States has shifted position that some of the courts of the United States have held over the years. It cannot be disputed that the trial courts of the state have a power of contempt. It is not here disputed, will not be disputed, that that power in a proper case may extend to the curbing of the press. And we do not contend that those who are in the business of participating in the operation of what is known as public press have rights which are superior to all rights granted anyone under the Constitution. Certainly that is not true. The press is amenable to the processes of contempt of the trial courts of the states, as well as other persons. It simply is that the press stands protected by a constitutional amendment, which certain other persons do not enjoy. Again, then, the problem arises in this gray area where it must be determined how the rights of the accused can be protected without an infringement of upon the rights of the press or the rights of anyone else whose rights are equally guaranteed under the Constitution. Now, the phraseology that is heretofore been used by many of the courts that a person's action where such as to reasonably interfere with the administration of justice may be punished by contempt is no longer the case, according to the Supreme Court of the United States. That phraseology is not sufficient. That boundary line is not properly drawn. The proper boundary line is that those acts must be of such nature as to create a clear and present danger that they will bring about the substantive evil sought to be avoided, as would be the case here, a clear and present danger that the accused would be denied his constitutional rights for fair and impartial trial. Now, there is, we submit, a very good similarity in the phraseology of the rules of the bench of Baltimore City, which I have just read, and the phraseology of the order of this court regarding this injunction. Those persons subject to the injunction were to refrain from making extrajudicial statements about this case, which involved personal belief of the declarant as to the guilt or innocence of the accused, the plans of the declarant relating to preparation and conduct of the trial, jurors, potential jurors, comments of the declarant about any evidence that may be presented, any treatment with any information concerning any known or intended witnesses or the treatment, acts, or attitude of the defendant, and are further enjoined from making any and all other statements which may be prejudicial to a fair trial by an impartial jury in this case, whether specified herein or not. We submit that that phraseology, which may be prejudicial to a fair trial, falls far short of the requirement which the Supreme Court of the United States has laid down that must be found before a member of the press could be punished by contempt for failure to obey the injunction. Now, as I say, that is the only case that we have come upon which bears reasonable factual analogy in reference and with reference to the facts here in a case where the rights of the accused under the Constitution are set off and to be set off against the rights of the press under the Constitution. Of course, the court is fairly familiar with the holding of the Supreme Court of the United States in the Shepherd case. The Shepherd case was referred to in the order, I believe, one of the court's orders. Counsel has referred to the Shepherd case and to the holding in the Shepherd case and has suggested that the order which this court has entered as to what should or should not be done, or what can or cannot be done, is on all fours is what the court in the Shepherd case says should be done. However, counsel failed to remark upon this striking fact that the court in the Shepherd case specifically did not say and did not recommend that the trial court ought to purge upon the members of the press. In fact, in the opinion, reading in part, we find the court says, of course, there is nothing that proscribes the press from reporting events that transpire in the courtroom. But where there is a reasonable likelihood that prejudicial news prior to trial will prevent a fair trial, the judge should continue the case until the threat abates or transferred to another county not so permeated with publicity. In addition, sequestration of the jury was something the judge should have raised sua sponte with counsel. And Ohio is now adopted over Trauman and so forth, skipping a bit there. If publicity during the proceedings threatens the fairness of the trial, a new trial should be ordered. But we must remember that reversals are but palliatives. The cure lies in those remedial measures that will prevent the prejudice at its inception. The courts must take such steps by rule and regulation that will protect their processes from prejudicial outside influence. Neither prosecutors, counsel for defense, the accused witnesses, court staff, nor enforcement officers coming under the jurisdiction of the court should be permitted to frustrate its function. Collaboration between counsel and the press as to information affecting the fairness of a criminal trial is not only subject to regulation, but is highly sanctionable and worthy of disciplinary measures. Now, it is noteworthy that nowhere, at least so far as we have been able to find, nowhere does the Supreme Court suggest that the trial court should issue an order curbing the press. It specifically refers to prosecutors, counsel for defense, court officers, enforcement officers, and others, and specifically states that, as I have indicated, there is nothing that prescribes the press from reporting events that transpire in the courtroom, and nowhere does it refer to press, to the press, or suggest that any order be made to curb the press either in the courtroom or out. Court further says, with reference to the procedures which it suggested in the Shepherd case, we conclude that these procedures would have been sufficient to guarantee Shepherd a fair trial, and so do not consider what sanctions might be available against a recalcitrant press, nor the charges of bias now made against the state trial judge. Referring briefly to the report of the committee made to the